Welcome back, Red Ice members. We are talking with Neil Kramer about the end of the Fourth Age and the choice of the life path, pretty much, at this particular time. We're talking about the nature of the path that we can potentially choose as at this time. I definitely want to talk more about the Hopi prophecy rock or stone and try to tie this into some of the science that actually is behind this idea as well. Then we want to discuss sorcery. We want to talk a little bit about television and paradox as well. So I hope we can squeeze everything in here in this last hour that we have together, Neil. But to recap a little bit on the prophecy stone, we talked about this idea that it's potentially something that is real as well. This is something that might actually happen, that we have a splitting and parting of the waves almost. The species go into two different strands. And the question if catastrophe is something real, if it's a real event, some people have tied the science into this, like Paul LaViolette, for instance. He has put this down to pretty much a matter of fact that the galactical center actually will light up, cosmic radiation will come in, this will actually produce this phenomena, which you call the blue kachina, pretty much. And a consequence of this is that the sun will be kind of encased in a layer of, I think it is like iridium or something like that, like a substance which is out into space, which will come in like cosmic dust almost, which will encapsulate the sun. And because of this, we will pretty much build up temperature inside this kind of layer and then eventually kind of explode outward, which means that our planet and many other ones, of course, in our solar system will kind of be baked in this radiation, in solar flares just bursting out from the sun. I don't know is that the way you view this, Neil? Do you view this as an actual catastrophe? The Hopi has this story of going down into the underground and saving a few of them, and then the rest, the remaining, the survivors, will once again come up on Earth, and literally it will be a new Earth. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting that. I think you had a guy on recently, Built Cliff, his name was.
That's correct.
Yeah. And he mentioned that some of the knowledge that was given to the Etruscan peoples was in their mythology, which, you know, I think we all know that mythology is kind of another word for history in a way, and not necessarily to be taken as fable. But in their mythology, a little guy came out of the ground and told them things to do, like this is how you build walls in a very clever, safe, and constructive way. This is how you till the soil. This is how you create, you know, agricultural space so you can feed yourselves in the future. And I think as you analyze these stories and as you analyze these disaster scenarios, one thing keeps popping up and one subject keeps resonating the same information in different languages and in different tonalities, but the same message, which is there's things under the ground which represent a much older life presence on Earth. And initially when I came across this information, it was in a very conspiratorial reflection, and it was, you know, there are the bases underground and there's lots of levels and they're doing experiments and it's full of aliens and it's all a bit unpleasant. And I thought, well, yeah, I can imagine that. I don't have a problem with that. I suspect there probably is. Why wouldn't there be?
Yeah.
But we're talking about something quite different than that, which is saying that races of humanoid or non-humanoid life that have been on Earth for a long time, who are aware and who can forecast much further than we can and say, you know, that there are these enormous elliptical orbits of planet X's that are going to come in and kind of, you know, pool table, smash everything to bits and things go out of orbit and the sun goes out. Or they, as you say, something affects the sun and the sun basically, you know, operates instead of, you know, a kind of electrical energy powerhouse instead as, you know, our own death knell in a way.
Yeah.
Because of what's occurred within it, then all these things can be seen from a long time ago and can be forecast in the future. Naturally, these people would say, well, you know, when these storms arise, because that's what they are, if they're on a galactic scale, it's a little bit more severe, of course, but it's still a storm. So just as in a storm, we open the storm cellar doors and go down into the cellar and remain there until it passes by, so they do the same. And in really severe cases where you have a hurricane that rips up whole, you know, communities like Katrina and so on, people leave. And in a galactic sense, people leave. So people get off the Earth and go somewhere else until this thing passes by. And again, on a galactic time scale, that's the blink of an eye, a few hours. In our time scale here, in linear time, it could be a million years or 200,000 billion years. We don't know.
Yeah.
But certainly, I think analysis of the moon, for example, the more I look at the moon, the more mysterious and unusual it becomes.
Oh, yeah.
And it does seem that, as well as it being a kind of a way station for various activities, it also has been put there, and it didn't used to be there, and it's there to keep a very specific rotational series of alignments in movement at very specific distances from each other. And it does not appear to be reflective of any of the characteristics of other solar bodies in terms of its rotational non-movement and so on.
Yeah.
So I think it's so, even for this alternative community that we speak to very often, even so, it's so alternative, it's so far out, that as you begin to look at cataclysmic events on Earth, we A, realize that they have concurrently happened and regularly happen through the Earth's history. And again, I'll use the word natural. They are natural events. And as the storms come and as the winter comes, so they will return and so they will continue to do so. What matters is, what is the state of technological, what is the state of spiritual, and what is the state of emotional advancement? So if your technology is rudimentary and you're like emotionally restrained and spiritually in a place of extreme poverty, then you could have a lot of problems. So it's no use having just one without the other. You need kind of a careful balance of them. And I would say, based on the information in the books that I've read, that it is clear that these events happen all the time, and the life presence on Earth has mixed results in how it copes with that. And I think certainly some of the research I've been conducting for the Sacred Albion project of mine leads me to the idea that, as with the crop glyphs, as with the crop circles, we see that the sacred spaces have multiple uses. One of them is as an energizing point, as a healing point, as a kind of kind of a fuel station, if you like, a petrol station, a gas station.
Right, right.
One of them is, of course, as a calendar, but also they seem to, as I mentioned earlier, give specific coordinates for things, and these could represent safe spaces, not necessarily in the 3D, but in a fourth dimensional context, as in 4D being temporality,
yeah,
or even a fifth dimensional context where time and space are, you know, kind of removed from the equation, really. So these things seem very much to serve as portals, which is not a new idea, but in the context of the study of cataclysms, and certainly going back to people like, I can't remember his name, is it Emmanuel Velikovsky?
That's right, yeah.
We see that there is a definite knowledge 2,000 years ago, at the very, very, very earliest, possibly going back 20 to 25,000 years ago, which would represent that 25, 26,000 year cycle. And if life is advanced in a state of particular spiritual attunement, it would, of course, care for the life that is going to follow it. And what would you want to do? You would want to leave a message for them, and you would want to leave pointers and guides for them. But if the solution is a little bit more complicated than just make big bunkers and hide from it, the Hopis expressly kind of condemn that as pretty crappy thinking. Mm-hmm. So you can't just build shelters and hide from it. It doesn't work like that. This is about a change of consciousness. It's about a move to, as I say, using the old terminology, what we call a move to spirituality. And they say shelters won't necessarily save or work in the way that you would think they would. The safe spaces are not three-dimensional hideouts or shelters. They are a raised level of consciousness. And if these rays do come in, and I was kind of looking at some gamma ray research that was being written about in one of the science magazines recently, and they were saying that these it always sounds funny when you say cosmic rays, but that is what they actually call them, isn't it?
Yeah.
These cosmic rays that emanate from the center of the galaxy have very peculiar properties, and they do seem to kind of diffuse matter in a way and make it less dense. So you could say, well, that's a disaster, because that will mean that material form is deconstructed and obliterated. However, if you were on a spiritual path, one of the kind of central tenets of whatever system you study is that you move into this more etheric body, into this more pure energy state. And as we know, energy is unlikely to be completely obliterated. It just changes form. So you would be consciously moving to a state of less dense matter. Even in the old legends, you know, they talk about that the more filled with light you are, and for light read consciousness, the lighter your being becomes, almost as a tangible lightness.
Right, exactly. And one point here that I think dovetails with this then is that the cosmic radiation in a way kind of performs a mutation of our of the species here on the Earth,
a mutation of
the planet. Yeah,
that's exactly it. I think, as I say, what we're talking about is with low consciousness, we have a divergent mutation. With high level of frequency of consciousness, what we're talking about is an opportunity for evolution. Is let us say, for example, that the DNA has been fiddled with, which certainly it looks like it has, and a lot of connections have been shut off. This is the thing that periodically comes around and say, okay, just in case the humans get themselves in the shit again, every 26,000 years we'll reboot the whole thing.
And sorry to cut you off, Neil, but I have to get this out here. So in a way, this is interesting, because what we potentially are looking at here then, if this is true, and if the elite factions, the ruling force on this planet right now, are aware of this, they are probably the one who's going to try to hide away from this, shy away. But actually, in matter of fact, this might be something that will benefit those who are on the surface, meaning that the transformation will take place by those who have no fear of the event itself. And in the meantime, they will go away, hide in their bunkers, and kind of, if you know what I mean, miss the boat, miss the opportunity to actually evolve, you know. And some of these things seems to be suggested in the activities that are being taken place right now. I mentioned this many times on the show before, but the Global Seed Vault, for instance, which really physically is what you talked about before, the new seeds, right? Or they're going to store these away to bring them up at a later point.
That's the one in Svalbard.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. So it's interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting. And I think that anybody who is operating on a kind of negative, illuminist, old hierarchical way is operating out of fear. I don't think it's possible to operate in a position of consciousness and light and you know, kind of communal connection. It's not possible to do that and, you know, severely try and restrict other people's growth and desperately, frenetically try and protect your own ass, basically, and get, you know, your own family and friends all catered for in these kind of tombs that they, you know, they are building, and you can see photographs of it if you look around on the net. You know, these things are constructed, and I think it is a time of culling if you're negative, and a time of destruction. What has to come about is this movement from fear, basically. And you know, fear is one of the things that is used so ingeniously to take people's eye off the ball and, you know, move on to the wrong subjects, really. So if people consider the evening news to be their primary source of information about the outside world, right now is a shit time. And when these cataclysms begin to reveal themselves, some very quickly, you know, if we get a coronal mass ejection, that's like all the technology switches off a very, very short time afterwards, and some of it is fried.
That's right.
So, you know, these plasmic kind of loops that fire out of the sun all the time, you know, some of them I can't remember what it's called, transgressive or something, I can't quite recall, but these loops fire out millions of miles and just fry all the chips in all the technology, which even in like a modern car means you won't be able to start your car, you won't be able to switch your computer on, the telephone systems, ISPs, all gone. So some of these things can happen very quickly.
Yeah.
If you're watching reports of that on the news and studies of that in these popular science magazines and stuff, it's all very propagandized and all very fear-based. And I mean, I talked about this in a recent essay, but you know, fear really, if we examine what it is, fear is a hardwired neurological response which is designed specifically to get an organism, a human, out of trouble, or an animal out of trouble, or whatever.
Yeah.
And I kind of was discussing some of the work of this psychologist called Plutchik, who suggested really that there are actually a very small number of human emotions, each of which bind together to create adaptive survival strategies. So, you know, basically you can go out, reproduce and be successful as a species. In other words, you know, they keep you alive so you can fuck, basically. that's what emotions are for,
right,
in a purely neurological sense. And the eight primary emotions, fear, anger, sadness, disgust, surprise, anticipation, acceptance and joy, you know, you move these together and kind of like a color chart, as you blend them, you know, you can say, well, this emotion and this emotion produces melancholy, which is a more subtle thing. You know, sadness and anticipation may produce depression, for example. Surprise and joy may produce bliss, for example. You know, so there's lots of different things with that. And whilst we know, we understand that there are other uses for the emotions, what we must say is that if we don't understand how fear actually operates, then it's being exploited in us. So it's worth considering how that works. And fear essentially works like this. A stimulus event occurs, a threat, in other words. You become cognizant of that. you see it. The cognition in your brain happens. And the feeling state arises within you. So the fear comes about. And then the overt behavior is you escape, you run away, or you fight, or whatever, and you know, then you're safe. So organically, it makes sense. And as you know, as I said, I used an example that I can't remember what it was, but if you're confronted by, let's say, a rhinoceros that is protecting its young, you know, very aggressive, defensive thing, you see the rhino, you hear it snort and stamp its feet and, you know, scrape the ground, and you feel fear and you climb a tree as fast as possible. So, you know, stimulus, cognition, feeling, act, get to safety, yeah?
Yeah.
In an intellectual context, however, you know, we're abstracted from all that. So a powerful fear response can be derived from constructs that are not immediately in our environment, so threats that are not directly perceivable, such as economic collapse or swine flu or looming war with China or Russia or North Korea, civil unrest, terrorism in Jakarta or whatever, you know. And, you know, it sounds familiar to people, I'm sure. So what the veil of unreality that's kind of pulled over people's eyes does so brilliantly is it bypasses the stimulus event altogether and just delivers the perception straight to you, ready for an automatic gut reaction.
A response.
Yes, exactly. So these people are the least capable of discussing cataclysms or terrorism or Palestine or anything that deserves attention and proper study. You know, this is not ever covered in those things. All they're interested in doing, and this is done covertly, is broadcasting this fear. And what I did for the essay I wrote was just on that particular day, I just had a load of feeds set up to various news sources like BBC, CNN, Reuters, whatever, all the key players, and just took the headlines and took out all the words like and it and in and stuff and place names and things like that and people's names. And what I was left with was a bunch of words, and I'll just fire them off to you very quickly.
Yeah.
And you can immediately see what these words have in common. Expelled, kills, strikes, attacks, stress, die, fire, accuses, torture, alert, flood, abuse, dies, war, embarrassed, row, pawn, target, death, poor, protest, killed, swamped, failure. Okay?
Yeah.
So that is one day across all the different so-called quality news portals, including like The Guardian and The Telegraph and stuff, which are supposedly, you know, relatively good newspapers here, and every single headline contains a negative resonator, and it's like that every single day. So the actual content and the context and the perspective of each piece is immaterial to the subconscious mind. It's the what I describe as the montage effect of these trigger words that counts. So the corresponding primal response is fear. So the news, the content of it is almost irrelevant. It's the fear that it brings about. So, you know, if they want to say, if the old hierarchy say, okay, we know this thing's coming, it's going to take many different shapes and forms. Maybe the sun's going to be affected, the moon, there may be a, you know, an elliptical visitor on a long orbit that comes back in and kind of sends things a bit crazy. All these very dramatic narratives, as they begin to unfold, they may think that as fear becomes at its highest point, that they can, if you like, maximize all the people who are kind of left behind in a certain way. So if, you know, if we consider that, you know, an emotion, like everything else, is a vibration, you know, why would they do this about fear, fear, fear? Why do they want this? Let's consider that fear is an emotion, okay? And emotions, like everything else, just like a guitar or a, you know, a plant pot or a rock, everything is an emanation of energy, a configuration of energy. And specific configurations of energy have specific characteristics and composition. And as I've said before, you know, these may be kind of likened to what you get in particle physics. So to describe particles, you describe them in terminology like charge, gravitation, spin, velocity. And emotions can be considered in that way. So this goes equally for what we could say are shadow emotions, negatively charged emotions like fear, hatred, despair, and also for what we could say are luminous emotions, positively charged emotions like joy, love, compassion, etc. So everything is an energetic emanation. And in the same sense that positive and negative charge does not necessarily signify good or bad. You know, a negative ion is not bad. Negative polarity in a battery is not bad. It's just the reverse of positive polarity. And so we begin to understand what fear is. So fear is a negative charge. And just like in physics and just like in, you know, metaphysical considerations, negative charge can be used as a resource. So just as a solar panel converts photons into electricity, emotional charge can be collected and transformed into power, into a resource or a food. So in my own personal experiences, systems, let us say, exist outside of the three-dimensional construct in fourth and fifth dimensional spaces, and they have specific power requirements that necessitate the accumulation of this negative emotional charge. So fear has a very, very important role to play for the old hierarchy, because they are linked to, you know, the oldest peoples on the planet who've been kind of, you know, manipulating this game for a good 25,000 years, probably longer. It's not a new story. Anyone who looks at conspiracy and New World Order, that is just the very, very latest micro blip on the radar. The real story is far older and grander and stranger. What we see is that this fear is a definite resource that is required. So the best thing you could do is populate the planet to its maximum. We've got 7 billion people on the planet now, at least. And some of the projections are, you know, still out as far as I'm concerned. So it could even be more. But 7 billion people on the planet, many of them in a state of anxiety, whether it's wondering where your next meal is coming from, or whether it's wondering if you can pay your mortgage, or whether it's wondering if your pension is going to be there when you're an old guy. This anxiety reveals itself and expresses itself in many different ways. So this reflective fear response, which lacks any stimulus, and most of it, certainly in the Western world, where we're, you know, relatively well catered for food and security and those basic sort of physiological needs, is fake. It's fear mind control. It's as simple as that. And it's just as a horror film is mind control. It makes you jump. It makes you scared, and it makes you, you know, want to switch the light on or whatever. So that is mind control. This is mind control. It does the same thing. It affects your mind and it alters your consciousness.
Yeah. And to me, that is actually, in one way, that's the definition of sorcery in one sense. You're using someone else's, you know, you make them participant in what you need. And to me, in one way, that would make sense for the reason for all the hardship, evil, and fear that exists on the planet right now. And this has been suggested by others as well, you know,
and
you know, it's there. And the question again is that, you know, we are participants in that, meaning that we give our energy away to this, whatever it is that they're actually using this energy for, or for whatever reason, you know. It could even be to tighten the noose around our neck even more. We don't know yet, but that some kind of, almost as I see it, a technology exists outside of the 3D realm to harness negative energy and fear to kind of charge up whatever it is that they need.
That's right.
You know, it's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. And you know, one of the things I'm going to talk about at the Beyond Knowledge conference, in Pan-Dimensional Encounters is the name of the talk, and that is, this is kind of what this is about, because these systems can be experienced directly. And some of them are life systems and some of them are inorganic systems, shall we say. Mm. And I don't want to go too much into this, but I think to some degree, some of this fear harvest, if you like, may occur quite naturally at times, yeah? But the sheer volume of the human yield, shall we say, combined with, you know, careful study of this, does show an intentional and determined suppression of, you know, the natural conscious evolution of man through this constant synthetic stimulation of fear. And when we get stimulation of fear, we get an overstimulation of the ego. The ego, you know, which really is just there to keep us alive, and we've talked about that on this program before, but the ego starts to get too big for its boots and starts to dominate. And when the ego dominates within us and starts to elbow its way around and push through the room, all the subtler emotions and all the subtler aspects of our psychology, the psyche itself, the real authentic self, recedes, because the real authentic self is quite a feminine, ethereal being, and the ego is very concrete, it's very masculine, so it just gets elbowed out of the way. So, you know, this fear response has the overall effect of cutting off man from the solar source, as we've said again, the sun, and unable to receive this galactic information and unable to transform these rays that are coming from the center of our galaxy, which are absolutely scientific. If people need that proof anymore, you shouldn't do, but if you do, go and find out, it's there. You know, we're ignorant of the integral experience that these potentials can bring to us, this multidimensionality. People don't even know what that means, most people. But we would hope that there is beginning to arise an understanding that all these things are interconnected at a metaphysical, quantum, and spiritual level. Everything is one flawless, flowing system. So fear then is like an oil slick from a ruptured tanker that spills this thick black sludge into our pristine ocean of consciousness, and it spreads.
Yeah.
And it you know, it brings toxins to every part of the system. So, you know, now from a wider shamanic perspective, again, let's use an old word, a shamanic perspective, we must observe that the old narratives of light and shadow are really, at the very deepest level, are fundamentally seeking their own integration and completion in the conflict. The micro amplifies out to the macro level. So what we see as these external enemies, yeah, these external cataclysmic forces and evil beings, or whatever you want to call them, to a degree, they are our own disowned shadow.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they are asserting themselves as an external other, and they demand either our insight or our blood.
Hmm.
And yet both are but reflections of a single entity.
Yeah.
You know, we are them, they are us. There is nothing truly outside of us. So long you reject your own inner shadow side, which is not bad, it's just the opposite polarity of the other. Yeah, negative, positive,
absolutely,
plus, minus, light, shadow.
Yeah.
If that is disowned and we disavow the existence of that, it will seek its own integration by apparently externalizing itself to come back. And as I say, we either need to integrate with it and understand it and absorb it and go through it, or it's going to kick us in the teeth.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I rewatched the last of the Matrix movies very, very recently, Revolutions or whatever it's called. And again, it deals very much with this idea that, you know, the character, main character, Matrix, Neo, I mean, deals Neo, with his anti-version of himself, Agent Smith in this case.
Yes.
And the battle, which finally ends, I don't want to give anything away so people who don't want to hear it. But anyway,
I know what you're saying. I'm seeing it in my own mind's eye now. Yeah.
They're absorbing into each other, meaning that they actually integrate, and this is what caused the fighting to stop, pretty much. You know, this is what brings peace between the machines and the human beings.
And that's right. And yet, if you look at the first film, Agent Smith is the epitome of the enemy. He's a super enemy, almost unstoppable, and, you know, so destructive and so aggressive that you just think, well, clearly there is our enemy.
Mm.
Whereas if you have a firm belief system, you would characterize him as, you know, the new world order leaders, or this particular brand of alien, or this satanic figure or whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas in reality, as we progress through this Gnostic trilogy of the Matrix, because that is what it is.
Absolutely.
You have the Lord of the Archons, the Demiurge, who is the architect, and you have these good and bad Archons, don't you? Like Persephone and the Oracle and the Train Man and so on.
Yeah, the Keymaker, the Merovingians.
That's right,
and, yeah.
The Merovingians, exactly. These are the Archontic forces that exist. And we see this kind of timeless narrative of Neo fighting Smith, and only as you get to the end you discover that they are reflections of each other. And as you say, without kind of spoiling it for anyone who's not seen it, it's quite a deep resolution in the film.
Absolutely.
It's quite a deep storyline that we're brought to. And I would encourage everybody to, everybody says, oh yeah, The Matrix is good, Reloaded's all right, and Revolutions is shit.
Oh, no.
They are essentially one film, like, you know, The Lord of the Rings three movies are one film in a way.
Of course.
And it's good if you can create the environment to watch them together. And if you watch it with the filter, with your own Gnostic filter in place, and don't worry too much about the story and the action and all that, but just focus on everything that's going on. It is, you know, it is a very rewarding experience.
Absolutely,
Which is ironic, because what I was going to mention was we've mentioned a few times in this about fear, and we've mentioned about raising vibrational levels and low vibrations and low consciousness and high consciousness, etc. One of the themes that crops up quite persistently, sometimes it seems without my consent in the cleaver, although it just keeps surfacing, is television.
Mm-hmm.
And television is a key component of this. And again, trying to distill a lot of complex themes and refine them into very quick, easy to understand statements, because I think, you know, we do need our own sound bites sometimes just to serve as kind of reference points for this material, and if it sounds good, then go and look at it. But I must clearly kind of focus on the fact that I am seeing that television is really designed for a single primary purpose, which is to lower the frequency of consciousness in the viewer. And that is what it's for. And any entertainment or art or whatever is purely coincidental, or is purely irrelevant. So although you may see a good film, although you may see a crap soap opera or a brilliant nature program or awful news, to some degree watching television does lower consciousness. And in this sense, you know, TV is, to a degree, TV represents to the visual arts what pornography represents to sexuality.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, yeah.
So it's cheap, it's fast, desensitizing, despiritualizing, dehumanizing. It's a Big Mac for the mind.
Yeah.
And you might think, oh yeah, I could just do with the Big Mac now, that's fine, I'll just chuck that down. And it's okay, it can be a pleasurable experience, but you know it's shit for you in the long run, yeah?
Yeah.
So to a degree, whether it transmits a kind of positive or negative effect on the ego, most of the time through the television, certainly in the evening programs, we're seeing a lot of grief, conflict, shouting, crying, domination, survival, pain, etc.
Yeah.
And this is representative of the, you know, of Hollywood basically, and in their own crappy way, even the sort of little domestic national channels in Europe and the UK and in the States are trying to reflect some of those Hollywood hooks that actually make people watch things.
Yeah, that's right.
So the artistic content of the show is largely irrelevant. It's the tonality and the imagery that counts. Mm. So you may watch a wonderful drama about child abuse, which is explores some very important issues, and you know, it visits some extremely important information on the audience, and yet it is something that you're consenting to bring about this extreme negative pull into your own consciousness. So you know, I know particularly I would say TV is aimed at women, again to neutralize that extremely potent force that women have naturally in abundance, is neutralized by television. And a lot of TV is focused at women, and I wrote about this a couple of years ago at the Cleaver. The article is simply called TV is for Women. Yeah, so
check
that out. Yeah.
Yeah,
and I think a number of other sites carried it, and I got a lot of attention on that, and even the people who were maybe in disagreement with some of the things says, but I see what you're saying. But by and large, most people are saying you're absolutely right. And TV in a sense is self-harming. Yeah. So people intoxicate themselves with this garbage just to momentarily escape the suffering and the blankness of their own inauthenticity. So even people say, oh yeah, I'm just watching a bit of TV. Yeah. I'm just going to watch TV and, you know, just chill out for a bit, just leave me alone. You know, it's a sordid form of voyeurism, and although it masquerades as game shows and reality shows and dramas and documentaries, we're talking about voyeurism essentially. So you know, this neutralizes this profound connectedness of woman to the planet, to Gaia. The earth energy grid itself recedes from them. I mean, in the raw natural state, I would say most women are born with this profound connection to the planet, and that's gone usually later on. Mm. And so what the TV does is encourage, a lot of the time, is it encourages women to adopt this masculine reductionism of men.
Yeah.
And so what we see is aggressive women and bossy women, or, you know, sexually predatory women, you know, who are kind of hailed as champions, as new women, and so on.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, you know, they're taking the all the cool stuff and all the free, raw, excellent female energy, and they're deactivating it and rebranding it. So the natural, once again, as with the Hopi stuff we talked about, is switched from the organic, from the natural to the synthetic. And this frequency of consciousness is once more flattened out, is lowered. And, you know, many people are kind of lost in this thing. So TV certainly does promote the acceptance of serfdom, a kind of literal and spiritual serfdom with all the debt that, you know, that entails. And as I said recently in something, that, you know, the simple predominance and existence of people like Simon Cowell and Paris Hilton is an indication that we're in big trouble.
I'd agree with that. Absolutely right. Oh my God. Yeah, it's and you know, one thing that you kind of I guess preface a little bit is that occasionally you get these you know, obviously brilliant things that kind of come through this medium. You know, there are some people who understand, okay, we have to work with the mediums that we have nowadays, be it cinema or TV or whatever. And once in a while you do get something good coming
of course,
out of that,
yeah.
You know. And but again, as you said, I mean, a trilogy like The Matrix, for instance, has what I consider to be a reason for the violence in there, for instance. It gives,
yeah.
When you watch it through, you understand, okay, you understand that the violence actually is an explanation for something. It means something else, really, you know.
Of course. And of course, you know, it's important for us to say, if you bring consciousness to the situation, if you bring consciousness to watch the Matrix trilogy, let's say, then you, to a degree, temporarily immunize yourself from this negative force that's within what you're watching. What I'm talking about is the kind of unconscious absorption of whatever's on the screen. You know, people who will sit down, put the TV on, say, what's on tonight?
Yeah.
You know, the TV should not be going on unless something fantastic is on that you already know about. It should never be just switched on and eaten like, you know, garbage. It doesn't, you know, it's not kind of meant to operate in that way. And, you know, this brings us back to a theme that, again, that is important in my work, which is imagination. And I would say that my focus on imagination is critical in explaining all this, because I see imagination not as a toy and as an artistic palette necessarily in itself, but as a crucible of manifestation. So I've described it previously, imagination as a kind of holographic generator. So with, you know, intent and power and resonance, what is a coherent imagining in your own self can become an actual component of the lived world. So what we may think of as an internal, you know, purely pretend construct actually becomes a living, breathing part of reality. And what I say is that if you're not aware of this, then effectively your imagination is not your own. It belongs to somebody else.
Yeah, that's right.
So the danger of watching, you know, TV and movies, if you're not conscious of your imagination, is that your imagination is essentially sequestered, is co-opted by someone else, and it isn't yours anymore. And you've effectively been hijacked, and you're serving, you know, the old hierarchy, like you've kind of been trojaned and turned into like a spam bot computer, and you're just sending out someone else's shady emails, you know.
Yeah,
it's true. Like you're no longer doing your own thing, you're no longer sovereign. So I think if you know your own self and you become authentic and you're in your integrity and you're learning and growing, you can be largely immune to this stuff. But as we know, sadly, although the numbers are growing, that most people are not. 99.9% of people you'll ever meet are unconscious. And they've been made unconscious because they've been suppressed. So it's only a new growing number of people, still small though, who can penetrate that kind of TV mind control and say, I know what's going on here. And I would say that, I mean, I've said this to somebody recently, that it is a characteristic of kind of gnosis and, you know, self-illumination, that if you've gone far down the path, it does become quite unpalatable television and difficult to watch. Yeah. And what everyone else shrugs off and laughs about or thinks is a funny comedy or, you know, a great drama, you just think is shit, basically.
That's right.
Because, you know, illumination just absolutely cuts through that stuff, and it just becomes a really sort of empty hologram, you know. So once you bring consciousness into it, it's like a kind of quality filter, and, you know, it scores it from 0 to 10 instantly, and you just know if you're watching something that is wonderful or something that is garbage. And as I say, you know, most things are purposefully there to just put out negatively charged emotion and to lower the vibrational frequency of what you're doing. So, you know, we have to choose carefully what we do with that screen in the corner of the room. It's a very, very powerful kind of magical object.
One thing that I know that you wanted to talk about as well is this idea of sorcery. And to me, at least, you touched upon this a little bit already in regards to how our potential, you know, our negative emotions are being used to power something else. But what's your, I guess, interpretation, or how do you view sorcery? From what perspective do you look at this?
Yeah, sorcery actually is a word that I quite like, and I associate sorcery with the Toltec tradition, where the basic premise of sorcery is that the world of everyday life is not real. It's not external to us, and as we believe, we see the world, it is a projection, and the consensus reality construct is merely a description, not a thing, but a description of a thing. Yeah. And so, particularly in the works of Castaneda, regardless of what was invented and what was actual, we are taught through the personage of Don Juan how to see rather than just look. Okay. So I mean, to some extent, we're taught how to extract mind from consciousness and just be, and, you know, into the world of timelessness and expansiveness. And in that terminology. This is called stopping the world. Mm. So being a sorcerer in this way is about mastering one's own navigation through the mysterious universe, and not necessarily endeavoring to constantly map and understand it, but just merely to traverse it and move through it with integrity. And that in itself is enough, though inevitably, you know, there are some techniques and landmarks and energy dynamics along the way that can be learned. So, you know, there are many definitions of words for what is more commonly understood now, perhaps as a shaman. And I think if Castaneda had written the book now, he would have used the word shaman instead of sorcerer, because sorcerer has taken on these negative connotations. And I think the locals used to refer to Don Juan as a brujo, which was kind of like a witch doctor in a sense, as perhaps is a translation we would use. But in my sense, it's somebody who moves between different dimensions, who seeks personal gnosis and enlightenment, and who serves the community of which they are a part. So we see different words with shaman, sorcerer, witch, you know, whatever terminology you want to use. And as I discovered recently, in many Aboriginal Australian communities, the shamans there are simply called clever men. So, you know, that's typical Australian understatedness, in that they don't have any fancy words for it. They just call them clever men. So, you know, it's we're talking about magic in the Victorian or the Crowleyan sense of the word. And in Crowley's book, Magic in Theory and Practice, he defines magic as the science and art of causing change to occur in conformity with will. And I would say, you know, that's a pretty fair description of any sorcery, if you like. And in the consensus reality tunnel, sorcery, as I just said, suggests negative supernatural powers and manipulation, black magic and ill intent and stuff. But these terms and these associations were really, you know, turned against themselves during the sort of Christian Catholic extermination of indigenous European shamanism from the 14th century right up to the 18th century in across Europe and in Britain. And I wrote about this just recently, actually, so it's fresh in my mind. But it was Pope John the 22nd who, in a long, long time ago in modern history, in 1320, formalized the persecution of witchcraft, or Wicca, as it was called then. I mean, Wicca is actually a sort of neo-pagan religion, but the old word for witch was Wicca, by sanctioning this explicit prosecution of sorcery, as it was, as they described it there, in the shape of, you know, the infamous Inquisition, where they would go around and basically kill anybody who kind of like talked to birds or plants, or, you know, any wore any strange clothes or slept with the wrong person or whatever. And this was a disgraceful sort of social manipulation that really preyed on the fears of a very basic and uneducated populace at the time, who did not have access to information, who could not read and write, and were very wary of supernatural forces. So this campaign, which was filtered through the religious apparatus, was really to remove shamanic indigenous traditions from the common man, to eradicate gnosis from the reach of the common man. And it was successful to a large extent. It, you know, those kind of practices disappeared. And hundreds of years later, in the late 15th century, Pope Innocent VIII issued what is known as a papal charter, which authorized two inquisitors, one of which was sadly was called Kramer, and another guy called Jacob Sprenger, to organize and carry out this massive campaign of what we now call ethnic cleansing, which was to disappear all the people who were connected with the land, who often were of a certain bloodline, a certain lineage. And these two men, Kramer and Sprenger, created this this book, this treatise on witches called Malleus Maleficarum, which in German is Hexenhammer. And it basically spelt the end of local traditions of what we, whether you want to call it shamanism or sorcery or magic or whatever, it just disappeared. And again, women in particular were targeted by this. So this campaign of state-sanctioned execution effectively tore the collective soul, you know, the spiritual morphic field of woman away from the land and its spiritual connectedness. And, you know, I would say we are still suffering from the loss of this feminine power today.
Yeah.
And so sorcery has really changed. And, you know, 2 millennia ago, if sorcery meant something very different. And actually, if you look at the word itself, the word sorcery comes from the Latin word source, S-O-R-S, which means oracle. Mm. So a sorcerer was someone who was an oracle, yeah? And it's only that negative set of memes, a memeplex as it's called, associated with sorcery, that's give it this kind of negative baggage, yeah?
Yeah.
So to me, sorcery has always been a kind of neutral, kind of fine word, but I understand it means a very negative thing, but I do detect the roots of that in the sort of medieval witch hunts of the time.
Hmm.
So it's one of those words that you have to be careful of, and I know certain researchers who frequent the noble corridors of Red Ice see sorcery as an evil thing. I don't.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting because, again, as you say, it's evidence, another evidence that the involvement of the church, particularly the Catholic Church, has been involved in, Orwellian newspeak for a long time, so to speak. They're trying to change the language. And
that's right.
And
yeah, that's right.
You know,
because I mean, if you go back to the word roots, I mean, it's a bit dodgy sort of etymology in that sense that you can, you know, form, you know, come up with so-called false positives, you know, that look like it's something that means something, but it doesn't. And, you know, you can get into lots of funny twists and turns, but, you know, a sorcerer in Latin was somebody, you know, who was in touch with fate, was in touch with the future, who was an oracle. So, you know, it's, most words are relatively neutral, in terms of usage. It's how they get, attached, you know, how these memes get attached to them. You know, it's very important to understand that. And a meme, just for anyone who isn't familiar with that word, meme, it's like a cultural item that is transmitted by repetition, in a same way that biologically genes are transmitted. So it's a viral unit of information. Unfortunately, it was coined by Richard Dawkins, who is not my favorite person. We have talked about him, but it's a very interesting thing. So a group of memes is called a memeplex, and you know, a memeplex is where memes are bound together to create a more sort of vigorous and successful levels of propagation. So particularly in religion and cultural and political systems, we see very successful memeplexes. So like, you know, sorcery is the negative application of magic for bad purposes, is a negative memeplex, and it's simply not true.
Hmm. That's a very, very interesting perspective. And again, in so many cases, this is what has happened, and this is the situation we're in. And I think that why this is important as well, why words and the root of words is important, is this idea that the words actually help to shape our thinking. We use the words to actually think with them. So either if our vocabulary is inadequate, or if it's in some way have been tampered with, you know, we actually are going to consequently think in another way. And that's why it's so important to kind of take back, I guess, the true meaning of the words.
It is. I mean, again, if you zoom out from this, the words are relatively neutral. However, you could also say, on the other side of the coin, that words are magic. Words are magical operations, and when you can say certain words and they have an effect in the world, just like a spell would in a storybook. You know, they do have that property.
Yeah.
If you think linguistically, as you say, if your thought internally is constructed as sentences that are spoken, then the words matter a lot more.
Yeah.
And so it becomes important. The thing that I talk about so often is this expansion of consciousness, to move away from this idea that you are a brain thinking. Because if you're only a brain thinking, you're thinking with the lexicon and the symbol set that is delivered to you.
Yeah.
And if that is carefully and closely manipulated, then you can only think in certain ways, which brings me nicely onto the subject of paradox, which I would very like quickly like to just skim over, because I think it puts a good light on a lot of the things we've talked about, you know, a really interesting kind of reflection of paradox in many of the things we've said. Mm-hmm. This paradox is very interesting to me, because what I see as a paradox, I mean, if you're a scientist or a rationalist, a materialist, strictly a materialist, I mean, it's good for us to be rational, of course, and it's good for us all to have critical reason, of course. But if you are a strictly scientific person, then a paradox really represents a, you know, self-contradictory statement or a false proposition. Mm, yeah. Mm. And it's a paradox. You reach a paradox, you bump into it, and you think, right, I'm going to turn around and walk back, okay? However, if you observe a paradox openly, without any belief, without any judgment, a paradox expresses something contrary to commonly accepted opinion. That's what it is. Mm, it violates the rules or the logic of the system that you find yourself in. So if you're profoundly attached to rules and logic, then you have no choice but to reject paradox. Otherwise, you'll suffer a kind of schizoid embolism, and, you know, you'll go crazy.
Yeah.
For information that lies outside the regular operating system of life, the first, you know, logical impulse is to find an analog, a reference point that lies within the operating system. So if we encounter a paradox, you see a crop circle in a field, that's a paradox. You think, what is this thing doing in post-industrial landscape of Britain,
yeah,
you know, just south of a big shithole city called Swindon? Sorry for any people who live in Swindon. You know, what is that doing there? It's strange. So if you are strictly adherent to the, you know, the logic of the system, the operating system that you find yourself within, you reject it. You say, well, it's obviously it's guys with planks and rope, and that's the end of it. Thank you. Move on. Okay.
Mm.
So if nothing can be found, then it's just simply rejected or ridiculed, discarded, yeah? And that's what a paradox is to a lot of people. And it's through really the study of kind of Zen koans, which we find a much more integrated and constructive encounter with paradox. And the Zen koan was basically a kind of traditionally a Japanese technique which was used to introduce to the student an interruption to the accustomed flow of their, you know, their discursive thinking, you know, constantly moving from one subject to another and lots of logic and lots of analysis.
Yes.
That discursiveness was interrupted. So the koan would cause the student to seek a conclusion to the puzzle of the koan, not through reason, but through intuitive faculties, shall we say. Not through logic, not through reason. So famous koans, everybody's heard, you know, two hands clap,
yeah,
and there is a sound. What is the sound of one hand clapping?
Yeah.
Okay, that is a koan. So with logic, there's no answer to that question. Another koan is a student asked this guy, Zen Master Wenyan, what is the Buddha? And the Zen Master replied, dried dung. Yeah? Which not only is offensive to the newbie Zen student, but is just peculiar, yeah?
Mm.
And yet buried in these statements, believe it or not, buried in these statements is the suggestion that logic doesn't require the answer. So very often the answer inverts the question and causes the student to think about the question a little harder.
Yeah.
So a more explanatory koan was given by a monk who asked Kagon, this guy. He said, how does an enlightened one return to the ordinary world? And Kagon replied, a broken mirror never reflects again. Fallen flowers never go back to the old branches. So that's a more poetic koan that, you know, begins to unveil, you know, something a little bit more transcendent and a little bit more valuable than pure information.
Yeah.
So the koan helps us to encounter new information. So if the control system dictates all the analogs, all the reference points, it effectively determines the entire mental symbol set, as we said earlier, the linguistics of cognition are set by the old hierarchy. What is real? What is unreal? What's acceptable? What's not acceptable? And, you know, within this linguistic system, is the suggestion that gnosis and natural evolution are opposed to the needs of the ego, and the ego is threatened by enlightenment. That's what the old hierarchy tells us.
Yeah.
So what paradox does is it teaches us that progression is achieved by encountering boundaries, by bumping up against paradoxical stuff. And it's at these points when we reach the parameters of known system, whether that's a theological construct, a philosophical construct, whether it's an emotional setup in your own life, whatever it is, when you reach the parameters of what you know, you will encounter a paradoxical artifact, which may be, as I say, a mental construct, it may be an object, it could be anything.
Yeah.
And these things resonate a proximity of new way of existing.
Yeah.
So in the same way that we encounter a crop circle, the crop circle resonates proximity of paradox. Yeah. And the formulation of paradox is very, very subjective. It cannot be measured or expressed as, you know, a simple, nice, tied up equation. As I've said before to people, paradox eats equations for breakfast. It's not interested in those.
Right.
The impulse of the intellect, and particularly prevalent in academia, will not help. Only the experiential matters in this. This is not something to be created in purely abstract thinking. It has to be encountered. So constructs of the mind and self must be put to one side in a paradoxical situation, and consciousness must be kind of permitted to expand, to merge with the paradox, where it serves as a portal in a sense.
Yes.
So, you know, we know that all things arise from the field, you know, from this great ultra soup of energy. Form exists, you know, it creates a guitar or a rock or a tree and goes away again. And to be in the field is to become the information. So self is an anchor. We need self to anchor ourselves. And localized consciousness is really just a reflection of the other thing. What paradox does, what paradox brings to this situation, is the ability to transcend that duality and bring essentially a wholeness to the situation. So wherever we encounter paradox, there is the opportunity for expansion and the opportunity for a greater kind of holistic understanding of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a fantastic example of a paradox is crop circles, because it is evident to anybody who's studied them that not all of them are made by men. In fact, many of them are not made by men or humans of any, you know, modern description.
Yeah.
So the paradox is left to the individual. And the point of the koan of the crop circle, is not to figure out who made them and how. That's pointless. It's irrelevant.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is a teaching in itself to bring the encounter a very, very personal, intimate flavor to the person who experiences it, to say, I'm going to give you an opportunity now to expand because you have reached a paradox. And there are many of these in our lives, but a crop circle is a very nice, easy to understand one.
So that
does affect a lot of the things we've talked about in these couple of hours.
Absolutely. And I think that's a good way to begin to round things up as well on a note for this time. And I like that idea that paradox is about transcendence. It's there as a kind of an unknown variable simply to take you further, almost to push you into a new direction and force you to look at something in a new way, you know. And and I guess what is interesting with the crop circle phenomena again, to tie things back to what we began talking about today, is that it seems to be aimed at more towards an audience of more than one, so to speak. It's not a personal paradox. It's actually for those who wish to look at it, a global paradox in that sense, or for a larger community of people in a way. And that's what
it is.
Interesting.
It does indeed have multiple layers like that, and there is information there. There is data encoded into the crop circles, no question about that. And again, study them, download them, look at them, read intelligent comment on them, particularly from a guy called Horace Drew, another guy called Jay Goldner, Freddie Silver. You know, there's lots of people out there, but there's a bunch of guys at the top of the tree there who will explain very open-minded, very simple, very informative of what we actually see before us, and what distinguishes, shall we say, an authentic circle from a piece of human art.
Yeah.
And that, you know, what we see is a very particular, a very determined presentation of paradox to the human, the individual human and the collective human. And as we approach it, as I say, the trick is for anyone who, you know, is interested in looking at these things, whether you're looking at them on a screen or whether you're walking inside them, is to switch the mind off. And the more you can do that, the more you can still that brain churn, the more holistic, enlightening and illuminating experience you will have, because that is what, for me, they're all about.
Thank you very much for your time today, Neil, and for a wonderful program. I want to remind people again about the Audio Cleaver, at least 6 hours of material written and read by Neil. Wonderful stuff. Go to his website, thecleaver.blogspot.com, or you can also take a look at them, cleavermedia.blogspot.com, or there's links from the main blog website as well. Wonderful to have you back, Neil, and we definitely should do this again soon, and I definitely want to wish you, if we don't see each other on the Beyond Knowledge conference, good luck at the speaking engagement there. But as I said, hopefully we can attend there this year as well, and we'll get to see you there.
Fantastic. Yeah, very much enjoyed it as ever, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity of speaking to your wonderful audience. Thank you.
Thank you for listening and for being a subscriber. I hope you enjoyed our program with Neil Kramer. My thanks to Fredrik and Elizabeth. Keep an eye on redicecreations.com and our member section, of course. We have much more good stuff coming up soon, radio and webcasts. Take good care of yourself, and we'll see you soon.